I'm Mark Hennick. This is So-Called Normal. I'm Mark Hennick, and this is So-Called Normal. Today on the show, we have Sharon Hampson. Sharon is one-third of my childhood soundtrack from Sharon, Lois, and Bram. She came in with her daughter, Randy Hampson. They have Skinamarink Day coming up on October 8th, and they have the book Skinamarink, which has reached number 2, I believe, on the Indigo bestsellers list. It's Heather's pick over at Chapters Indigo. We had an incredible conversation. I almost cried like 3 times during this conversation. So not that I hope you cry too, but I hope that you listen into this really fabulous conversation between a mother and a daughter and the power of the work that they have done to entertain children, to treat them with respect and with dignity, and to really value kids. I mean, that's why I connected with Sharon, Lois, and Bram so much as a kid myself. So here's my conversation with Sharon Hampson from Sharon, Lois, and Bram, or more recently from Sharon and Bram, along with her daughter, Randy Hampson, on So-Called Normal.
So there is an adult man who can't speak,
mm-hmm.
and he uses the elephant show.
Mm.
To find the words and the messages to express himself. If he can't find a word, he will go to a spot in the show.
And then stop when it's the word is coming.
Really?
That's incredible.
Yes. That's beautiful. Yes. And I'm you've probably heard stories like that all the time for years.
Right. So that, I mean.
And a lot of people who had.
Troubling childhoods.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Who had difficulty growing up and took comfort in feeling a relationship
sure.
with us.
So let's go back to the early days then, the establishment of Sharon, Lois, and Bram, of
sure.
course, at the time. Or was there anything that preceded that?
No, I mean, we all did music separately.
Yeah.
And we were colleagues and decided to make a record together. We did not decide to start a career together. So the career came as a surprise. I mean, it was the response to the record that launched the career.
Right. How long ago was that?
When 1978.
Wow. And was it an instant success or was there
yes.
a period of really?
Yeah. Yes, it really was. It was, I mean, we debated when our first record, One Elephant is Elephant, came out in the fall of 1978. And we debated about whether to press 5,000 records or 10,000 records. And we pressed 5,000 because we couldn't afford 10,000 and because we weren't sure that we'd sell that many. So the worst thing that can happen to you is that you don't sell any records.
Mm.
The second worst thing that can happen to you is that you run out of records right away and you don't have any more to put out there.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was a huge response right away.
Why do you think that is? What did it tap into?
I think, there are a lot of things. I think we were lucky with the timing, that those were good times for people and they could afford to spend on an unknown,
mm-hmm.
$7 or whatever the records were.
I can tell you some of the feedback that I've gotten about the mm-hmm. success of that record, because we just celebrated the 40th anniversary of it.
Yeah.
One thing that Sharon, Lois, and Bram did on their first record and continued to do was invest in quality musicians
right.
and in quality arrangements. And as music curators,
mm-hmm.
they picked interesting songs that would not annoy parents when
right.
they listened to them.
Acoustically interesting.
Just pleasing, not
yeah.
annoying, not derivative or mm-hmm. insulting.
Mm-hmm.
And not poor quality, as you say. We spent money on them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the artistry of it. It wasn't patronizing to kids.
Exactly.
Or
I mean,
parents.
Many parents have said to us, I drive my kids to school playing your music and I drop them off and then I carry on to work continuing to play the music.
Right.
I mean, it was important to us that parents should not run screaming from the room when their children were playing our music.
Mm.
So first and foremost, we had to please ourselves.
Mm.
We had to choose music that appealed to us. We were not there to teach a lesson.
Mm.
Lessons were learned from the music, but not because we chose the music to figure out what lesson we could teach. We never did that.
Right. So why children's music then? I mean, you were working as musicians prior to that, but why
kids? Well, We all were really working in children's music. Okay. I mean, Bram and I started out as coffee house folk singers, but I kept coming back to the connection with children. Mm-hmm. Lois had a music degree, mm-hmm. classical music degree, and she grew up on Broadway and show tunes and all of that. But mm-hmm. she worked whenever she performed music. When she started doing that, it was for children in her son's right. preschool.
Right.
So we all were naturally in that environment, and we worked with an organization called Mariposa in the schools. Mm-hmm. And we all went into the schools individually to sing with children in schools. So, and really what happened was that we were going to make a record with the Mariposa and the school's mm-hmm. colleagues. Mm-hmm. And because it was an organization that existed, it had to go through a board of directors and all of that. So it got delayed.
Right.
And the fellow who was going to produce it for us, Bill Usher, said, well, let's do one with us.
Mm-hmm.
And it was as innocent as that. Mm-hmm. No calculation, just, okay, let's make that record.
Yeah.
But we shared a fundamental philosophy, as Randy has described, mm-hmm. about the kind of quality of music that we were going to put out there for children.
Yeah.
So the preschool that Lois played music in happened to also be my preschool.
Oh, so I
Lois
was just going to ask
David
you about this. Yeah.
Has been one of my best friends
for our entire lives.
We knew each other since we were 3 years old in nursery school.
Yeah. But the mothers didn't know each other at that time.
Yeah.
So what was it like for you growing up? Did you know who your mother was at that time? Like being
You weren't so young
music.
Then.
We were, you know, Lois and my mother were musician friends.
Okay.
So once they started doing music together, I remember Lois once saying that her parenting philosophy was her son was along for the ride. So whatever she was doing, he was doing it with her. So we grew up listening to their music, being at their music parties, trying out songs with them, all of that. But by the time they recorded their first record, I was 13.
Right, right.
So I had the benefit of watching their meteoric rise and enjoying it by selling CDs and, well, originally LPs. You know, I was a teenager and I would sell records at the concerts and I would be running around backstage, and then I donned the elephant costume and I would dance as the elephant. Yeah.
And one time we were playing at Ontario Place, and Randy and Lois's son David were out there in the two elephant costumes.
Ontario Place, it's the Budweiser stage now, I think. So
it was a fabulous venue,
and it used to have a rotating stage.
Okay.
So it had a big opening where the artists would come out, and you'd start in the center, and then you'd end up like working your way all the way around. And we came out in these elephant costumes.
Getting
lost on
stage. Visibility
is not very good. And you're dancing around and trying to find your way off again, you know, as the stage is moving, would become a bit of a challenge.
That's funny. So you were a children's entertainer, too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And Randy brought us, over the years, she worked for us when she was older. She brought us a lot of repertoire suggestions.
Yeah.
And then the last couple of years, she's been managing us in our lives. For me and Bram, our lives got a lot better.
Sure.
And the only regret is that we didn't do that a lot sooner because it's been terrific. And she's full of ideas and energy. It's terrific.
Yeah.
Thank you, Randy.
Well, I mean, my other life, I'm a divorce lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So dealing with the misery of people's marriages breaking down, or dealing with watching two people deliver joy to
families.
Thousands and thousands of families.
I feel like stark contrast. Yeah, I know the record came out in the 70s, but I feel like, you know, late 80s through the 90s, you had Mrs. Doubtfire come out. You had all these kind of there was a lot of stories around divorce, around families, around kids who have real struggles. You know, kids' struggles aren't trivial. So I feel like in some ways, and maybe I'm just projecting all my own family stuff out here, but I do that on every episode anyway. I feel like that's why it was so important. There was something comforting about being able to
connect.
Well,
there was. And what's interesting about that is that we didn't know that, and we didn't set out with that kind of intention.
Right.
But I'll tell you a story about a wonderful young woman that we met when we went to northern British Columbia, to very small communities. And we were one of the communities. We did a little concert, and then we did a signing autographs. And mostly what people want, especially the ones who grew up on us, is to take pictures with us.
Right.
So we went through this process of signing, and a young woman waited.
It was late.
It was late.
It was you know, it's a children's concert.
Mm-hmm. And it was a weeknight.
It was a weeknight. And it was like 8:30 at night.
Oh, my.
And
I'm in bed by 8:30.
As the crowd is thinning, there's one young woman standing with a five-year-old.
And waiting.
And it's like 8:45. It was late.
She wanted to be the last person.
Really, yeah.
And she said, when she finally got to us, she said to me, I had a terrible childhood. My parents hated each other, and they fought constantly, and there was yelling and screaming. It was miserable. And the only thing that saved me was you and your music. She said, I went into my room, and you were there for me. She said she left home when she was 17. Mm. She's married. She has three children. She was weeping, and I was weeping, and you know. But we heard stories like that not infrequently about children who had a rough time, and they somehow there was something in our music that gave them comfort. And also, I think seeing us on TV, they saw three real people, no pretension. I mean, people say when they meet us, they say, you're exactly like you were on TV.
Right.
So,
which is so rare.
They're nice to each other. They were nice to the kids. One woman told me that she learned to parent from watching the Elephant Show because she had terrible parents.
Yeah.
And she did not want to be that kind of parent to her son, and that watching them talk to children in a respectful way and being kind to each other and inclusive was how she tried to model herself in terms of being a parent.
I like that.
So, so nice. How did the Elephant Show, when that came along, when did that come along?
It came out in, we shot it.
Yeah.
Well,
so
83 was the
pilot.
The pilot. We did a pilot with, you know, many companies came to us and said, would you like to do some TV? And we'd say, oh yeah, that's great. And they'd say, you know, have you got money? And we'd say, no. So then a company called Cambium came to us and they were two young guys. Neither one was a parent. Mm. They had nieces and nephews, and which is how they knew about us. And they said, let's do something. We did a pilot with them. We didn't know it was a pilot. We did a special with them called Sharon Lois and Bram at Young People's Theater. And in the course of doing that pilot, they found support for making a series. And that's how The Elephant Show was born.
Right.
You know, all these sort of unintended good results.
And it seemed like it was part of a wave, I kind of mentioned before, too. I mean, you had in Canada, Fred Penner was doing a lot of work.
You know, the Canadians were the...
Mr. Dressup?
Yeah. Oh, dear Mr. Dressup. Yeah. And we knew Fred, of course, was a friend, is a friend. It seems to me that the Canadian children's music industry was far and away the leaders in that industry. There were good performers in the States, but somehow, and maybe it's because we had a national radio network that, you know, CBC, where we could be singing in Toronto and speaking to people in Newfoundland and Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And we found, you know, very shortly after the record came out, then the next spring, we went to, we were invited to a children's festival in Vancouver, and they knew us.
Right.
We couldn't believe it. They knew us. They knew our songs.
Well, and although you're a quintessential Canadian children's band, you struck great success in the United States and around the world.
Huge. Right? Well, it was certainly in the United States, we had a very large career.
Yeah.
And different pockets around the world, but not universally. But
right.
Israel, Singapore, Australia. Yeah. They got recognized in London, England once, but it was by a family from Singapore.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Wow. My husband and I were in Hyde Park.
Yeah.
And I could tell by the way the woman, there was a family, I could tell by the way they were looking at me. Hmm. And finally, I sort of let her know that she could come over to me. And she said that she had seen, you know, the little beanie caps with
umbrellas on the top.
Yeah. And she remembered seeing one of those on the Elephant Show, and she saw them there in England, and that reminded her of the Elephant Show, and then she saw me. It was very cute.
That's adorable. And you played Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, that was very cool. We played a lot. We played
the White House.
We played it. We met with President Clinton and Hillary at the time. We played at the Easter Egg Roll, and we played at the Kennedy Center, and we played at a lot of really important places.
Did you notice any differences between Canadian and American audiences?
Not really. No. They were very devoted. I mean, American audiences would wait. By the time we started playing in the States, the Elephant Show had gone on Nickelodeon TV, and that immediately vaulted us into bigger venues, sure, and larger audiences. And so after the show, sometimes, you know, it would be an hour till we got out, mm-hmm, of the theater. Mm-hmm. And the American audiences, there'd be, you know, 100 people waiting, mm, to greet us backstage, mm-hmm, at the, you know, as we left. So they were very devoted. But, you know, Canada is where,
right,
the Canadians, you know, sometimes, I was telling someone today that sometimes someone will reach out to us and say, you know, I'm sorry for interrupting you and, you know, I hope it's okay. Mm. And I say, you know, without you, there'd be no us.
Right.
You know, without the audience, there'd be no success for us. So yeah. I never feel imposed on when someone reaches out to us.
That's so nice.
We were in Fort St. John in November, mm-hmm, and we went to dinner, and a man in his 30s came over and he said, I had a sister with severe disabilities, and your music was a constant comfort to her in, mm-hmm, her life and a moment of respite from the challenges of her life. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to come over and say thank you. And, you know, tattoos and leather jacket and like a real rough and tumble looking guy. Yeah. When we went to get our bill from dinner, he had bought our dinner.
I forgot about that.
It's the least I could do, yeah, to thank you.
Yeah. Wow.
And that stuff just, you never get tired of hearing that.
Right, right. You know, I have three kids, all under six.
Oh my gosh. And a very tired wife.
And a very tired wife.
And her husband.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. My eldest boy will be turning six on Saturday, actually.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I might have to get one of those pictures for him later that you mentioned. But it... you know, he's been taking up guitar recently.
Oh, and
he's been
at six.
Yeah, at six, yeah. So we have him in guitar lessons and he loves it and all that. And he's been really listening to a lot of different guitar music. And he keeps playing Queen over and over again. For some, I don't know why he connected with
do you?
Not really, no. My That's wife does a little bit.
Because usually they take to what their parents like.
Very often. And I think it probably came from my wife, but... He played Bohemian Rhapsody so many times that I had to tell him to turn it off because it was driving me a little batty. But when he would play Skinamarink over and over and over again, that was a comfort still for me. That I never got sick of him playing that.
And so, we never get sick of singing it.
Right, well, so this is what I wanted to ask you. You for 40 plus years now,
exactly,
you've been saying that same song.
It's very interesting. We never tire of singing that. And we sing that at the end of everything that we ever do. Yeah. So that meant TV, concerts, recordings, most recordings, right, public appearances that are, you know, not necessarily performances. We always sing it and we love singing it. Now it has new words because we have, mm-hmm, a new book.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
which
I saw
is
that.
Called Sharon Lois and Bram's Skinamarink. Mm-hmm. And Randy wrote all the extra words because the song Skinamarink is not long enough,
right,
to make a book.
Well, because wasn't it originally just the end of the show or was it a song?
Well, we used it for, but that's as long as the song is.
Right, yeah.
So Randy said one day, you know, we're going to need more words for this book. And if we don't want the publishers to write them, then we better do it.
Yeah.
How about can I take a crack at it, she says.
Yeah.
And then she does it. It's got an introduction. It's got three verses. It's got an extra. I don't know what you would call that. The lyrics are lovely. And the book is really about all the ways people can love, all the kinds of people and all the ways and all the places that people can love. It's all about diversity. Yeah. And we sing it in the show all the time. People love it. And they still get to sing the parts that they're familiar with.
Yeah.
So how could you tire of that? And people say, do you tire of it? Well, no. I mean, people are singing I love you to each other and to us.
Yeah.
There's nothing tiring about that.
Yeah.
And they get a break when they ask the audience to sing
their
solos.
Yeah, exactly. And they sing it. And it's so
they
beautiful.
They can do it for you. Yeah,
yeah, and it's so beautiful to hear that coming from them.
Sharon grew up with a folk background. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Pete Seeger was an idol. And he was the king of the sing-along concert, mm-hmm, you know, inviting the audience to join in. And that is always a high point of the shows when they give the music over to the audience.
Yeah. Thrilling.
And just listen to them singing every word.
And we do that a lot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we do it a lot.
And they have a lot of solos. Yeah,
sure.
They have a lot of solos. And we like it a lot.
Now, you've been performing, of course, with Bram for this whole time.
For all this time.
41 exactly. years.
41 yeah. years. Yep. So you haven't gotten sick of the song. Have you gotten sick of him? No.
That could happen.
Oh, okay.
No. We are really like family
right.
with each other.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, not just me and Bram or me and Lois and Bram,
sure.
but as Randy said, she and David, Lois's son, have been friends since they were little
yeah,
kids.
Yeah.
We're all like family to each other.
And that on its own, I feel like, is so rare, too.
It is.
You know, for bands to work
I
so
mean,
closely.
Bands break up because of relationships,
right.
not because of musical issues frequently.
Right.
But, you know, it's not to say we didn't have struggles.
No, sure.
But we work them out.
Yeah.
We were in Saskatoon in the spring, and we fly together. Then we drive to the hotel together. Then we eat together. Then we go play the gig. And then we get back from the gig, and Kirk, our fiddle player, hosts a party in his room.
Oh, nice.
So it's fiddle, keys, drums,
yeah.
Bram, Sharon, and myself. And I'm like, you know, we've just spent literally every minute together, and here we are sitting
hanging out
around,
together,
laughing
we go
and
to
joking. And
do you think that it's that relationship and that chemistry that comes over onto the stage, or is it just because you've performed so much on stage that you might as well spend the rest of your time together as well?
That's interesting.
Which direction does it go?
It's hard to know.
No,
yeah.
I mean, I think that you have to genuinely like the people,
yeah.
and Sharon and Lois were friends
yeah,
before
yeah.
they were colleagues, and
we shared values.
Their spouses, they would spend New Year's together and
yeah.
dinner parties and travel with each other. I
right.
mean, they genuinely share the same values and this, you know, supportive sense of humor. Brand is a terrible punster.
Mm.
He's like a word player, and he does wonderful jokes and. My mom says, I'm the best audience because he can tell me the same joke and I'll laugh every time because I'm hearing it for the first time.
Each time. It's true. I forget them. That works very well for him.
Yeah.
yeah.
Now, Lois, of course, passed away in 2015.
Yes, but she also stopped performing
right.
when her husband died. She was devastated by his death, which mm. was in 1997. That was a real blow for her. And she did a few shows with us, and then she said, I can't do this anymore.
Mm.
So we stayed closely connected through all those years. And then, as you say, she passed away in 2015. And we were with her all of that. I mean, we were close through those that period,
yeah.
but we were really with her when she was ailing and when she died, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But she, I mean, she, when I had my first child, she was
babysat.
One of my babysitters.
Mm, really?
And they had a standing Wednesday date together.
And she also, we were celebrating her birthday. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah. She,
and she said, you have to bring Ethan too. It was her little guy.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were very connected.
Yeah. What was she like, Lois?
She was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I wore my grade 13 prom as I'm wearing one of her dresses.
Really?
You know, yes. She used to. She had one son.
Mm-hmm.
And
she was devoted to Randy.
Would mm-hmm. take me clothes shopping. And, you know, her husband and I planned her 50th birthday party with her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just a.
And she was very creative.
Mm-hmm.
She was a wonderful cook and a fabulous baker. And she would be the first one to tell you, you have to taste this. It's the best that you've ever tasted.
and
it
was.
Yeah.
She was. Bram said what Lois needed more than anything was a good editor.
Mm.
She would have 100 ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you'd have to whittle them down to the one
sure.
or two that made some kind of sense. But she had a lot of ideas.
Real creative.
Yeah,
force,
oh, very
like.
Creative, yeah.
And she brought a different musical sensibility
yeah.
to the trio as well. Because
yeah.
Bram and Sharon had folk origins. And Lois really loved the American Songbook. And she loved pop standards and, you know, musicals. And so she brought and introduced to them a different kind of music.
And we loved doing it. I mean,
yeah,
we did sang those pop songs with her and we loved it. But
yeah.
we probably left to our own devices, Bram and I wouldn't have probably come up with some
right,
of those.
Right, right. Now, you had an opportunity to perform again with her. And I think you're known, Sharon, Lois and Bram were known as Midtown Toronto's most famous residents when a park was named.
Yes.
Playground was named.
Yes. It's the June Rowlands Park and the playground is the Sharon, Lois and Bram Playground.
Right. So we're we're regulars there, our family.
Are you?
We play the musical instruments.
I'm so happy. Nice. I mean, there were two events. One was the when they named the playground, and then they asked us to do the music garden, and we spent a lot of time choosing instruments for the music garden.
You chose those instruments.
Oh yes.
Oh yeah. Oh, wow.
Primarily Bram. I mean, I was involved as well, but he did a lot of research around the instruments. And the only one that was is a problem probably is the drums, because children can't resist climbing on them, and so they get
they also collect rainwater too, by the way. So when my little guy pounds on them,
oh, is that right?
they splash everywhere. But that's still fun too.
But we did do to launch the when the playground was named, and it was they've built a whole new playground since then. But when the old playground was named the Sharon Lois and Bram Playground, we did a concert there. Mm-hmm. And Lois, that was the last concert that she did with us.
Yeah.
Mm. And Bram and I did another one when the music garden was launched. And that was really fun. We had some of the political people from the region who played some of the instruments at that event.
My mom used to joke that she wasn't going to retire until she had grandchildren to sing to.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Lois had retired, but she did her granddaughter, Tessa, who is 11 now. She would go to California where they live, and she would go to Tessa's class, and they would do a concert together there. So she would make special cameo appearances. My sons both went for JKSK to a school called Bloorview, and it was an integrated kindergarten class. So half of the kids in the class came from the community, and the other half had physical and developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And every year, Sharon, Lois, and Bram, even though she had retired, she would come and do those concerts
at the end of the year.
Lois lost her husband in the late 90s, and how deeply that affected her. Of course, you lost your husband of more than 40 years. Just a few years later, really.
You know, all three of us lost our spouses. First, Ernest.
Yeah.
Then my husband, Joe, and then Bram's wife, Ruth. And they all died. This is weird. They all died in November of different years.
Really?
Yeah. It's kind of freaky. Oh, it's a terrible loss. My husband and I met my husband when I was 18.
Right.
And so we were together for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And he was very involved in our music. Mm-hmm. He was there at the very beginning. I was the only one of the trio who knew how to sing harmonies. Mm. And Joe did many arrangements. He played on the first couple of records, I think. Mm-hmm. And he wrote arrangements
for them.
He wrote songs for us. He did a lot of musical arrangements. And he got us to do really interesting harmonies, really interesting arrangements. And Bram says, Joe taught him, he said, Joe taught me how to sing harmony. I could never have sung harmony, but Joe explored it with him in a particular way. He said, here's the line, and I want you to think of this as your melody. It is the melody of this. And that's how Bram learned to sing harmony. So Joe was deeply involved in our music. Mm-hmm. And he knew every possible song. So did Bram's wife, Ruth. She knew a lot of music.
Yeah.
And so he brought us lots of ideas. And then he wrote a lot of terrific songs that we ended up singing, and some of which we have recorded over the last, six or nine months, year.
Yeah. Oh, really? So still producing a lot of new content.
Well, it's Sharon and Bram recording.
Right.
We'd never done that, just the two of us. We'd always recorded as a trio. And we stopped once Lois retired. There was no more recording.
Right.
Because we had a large
catalog,
sure, exactly. Yeah, sure. And then I think Bram said that he remembered one of Joe's songs that he really liked, and he always thought it would be nice to record it. And that started Randy on a campaign, and she kept digging up more songs of Joe's.
Oh, really?
We've done how many? About seven?
Yep. Oh, wow.
So, and we've had so much fun doing it, to go back into the recording studio and to bring to life. And Joe wrote some really wonderful songs. He wrote a song about the one of the lines is, how could anything be wrong with being different?
Mm.
Now, what a message for today.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to be different.
Right.
And he wrote several peace songs and the hug song.
Mm-hmm.
And we sing the hug song in the show, and we get the audience to hug.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a nice little Lois story. I mean, she had retired, and actually when my father was sick, Sharon and Bram had been doing a series of school shows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had lots of people bringing over meals and visiting and that sort of thing.
When my dad was sick.
Mm-hmm. And Lois said, I'm going to give you a break. I'm going to go and do some of those shows for you. She said, I'm uniquely qualified to help you. You know, other people can bring you food, but I can do this thing to help you.
Let me stay home.
Wow. So she came and did those shows. I think it reminded her why she was retired.
She got tired.
But yeah. And, you know, one of the wonderful things about the fact that they are recording again is that it has given me an opportunity to reconnect with my dad's music because I have written musical introductions to some of the songs and extended verses for some of the songs.
And arrangements.
And I'm working with them in the studio and executive producing all of this music. And I feel like it's such an amazing opportunity to extend two legacies, right? My dad's music gets out into the world for a new audience, and my mother and Bram get to share new music with their fans and their audience and everything.
Are audiences certainly the industry is different now than it used to be, but the children's entertainment, the audiences, is that different?
Get on the stage, they're exactly the same.
Right.
You know, we get on the stage, we start to sing, and they are right there with us doing it.
Mm-hmm. And that really, I mean, when I think back to the Young People's Theater concerts when you first started out, I mean, once people knew their material, one of the things that was wonderful about it was parents and children participated together. There was no abandon there.
Right.
And it's still the case. I mean, the adult fans who come without kids, they're not embarrassed. They're just standing up doing
I would do that.
Yeah. We love that.
They were on a phone-in show in Halifax, and a man called in to say to Bram, you taught me how to connect with my kid. I was too cool for school, and taking him to one of your concerts allowed me to let that go so that I could participate with him and have fun with him and do all of that.
Yeah.
And you know, he thanked him for that.
Yeah. I've hardly met anybody since probably the 80s who doesn't know the actions. Where did those come from?
You know, I'm trying to remember. You know, I know where the song came from. Yeah. I mean, Lois, when we first started, we needed to raise $20,000. It's so funny to think it was only $20,000 to make a record.
But in the 70s, I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. To make a record and pay our lawyer.
Right.
So we all went to our family and friends, and and, you know, they were devoted to us, and they gave us the money thinking they'd never see it again, which is not the way it happened. But Lois went to Chicago to her family, and she said to her cousin Lisa, hey, Lisa, do you know any good songs? And Lisa said, I learned these songs at camp, at Girl Guide camp. And she sang Skinamarink. Now, and so we put it on the first record. And Bram loves to tell the story that that he didn't even sing on it, that Lois and I sang. She sang the melody, I sang the harmony, and he played the guitar. We didn't know that it was going to become a signature song for us, obviously.
Sure. Yeah.
Now, I can't remember if Lois learned the actions from Lisa.
She
probably did.
Yeah, I'm sure it came back.
So they came through Lois.
It came to us through Lois from her cousin, who also was a person with a disability.
Right.
So it's kind of cool that she brought us that, gave us that gift.
Yeah. That's beautiful. You're certainly no stranger to adversity yourself. You're a 3-time cancer survivor, right?
Exactly.
When were you first diagnosed?
I was first diagnosed in 88.
Okay.
It's interesting. The preamble to that is that Lois and I went to a spa together. We were in Florida, and I had our last day there. We'd gone to exercise or something, and we were getting ready to leave that day. And I had a terrible dizzy spell, and it alarmed me because my mother had a condition called Meniere's syndrome, which is a horrible, horrible inner ear balance problem, which ultimately my husband got some years later as well. And it's horrible. And it scared me that I had this dizzy spell. So when we came home, I went directly to the doctor and we checked everything, and they couldn't find any explanation for that. And she said, well, since we're doing all this investigation, you might as well go and have a mammogram. And I had a mammogram, and something irregular turned up. And they called me to come back and have an ultrasound, I think.
And were the symptoms related?
No.
Wow.
It was just, there was never, ever after that, any explanation for the dizziness.
Right.
But it triggered the trip to the doctor,
sure.
And it triggered the first mammogram. And the day that I went back for the ultrasound was 1988. We were taking pictures for our 10th anniversary album cover.
Yeah.
And I went from the hospital, where they told me that something was wrong. Mm. And I went to the photo studio, and Lois was having her makeup done, and I walked in, and the two of us started crying. And so, you know, it's sort of memorable,
yeah.
Because when you look at that album cover, you see three smiling people. It's
and you
amazing.
Had just found out that
yeah.
you
had... Well, I found out, yes.
Yeah.
And so we were in pre-production for the Elephant Show, and I had to have some surgery.
Yeah. And then you went back
yeah,
to work.
I had actually two operations, and two little operations. One was a lumpectomy, and one was the lymph nodes.
Yeah.
Was it the lymph nodes?
Yep.
Yeah. And
chemo and radiation as well?
No. So that was the first time. Hmm. And second time was 4.5 years later in 93. And at that time I had radiation, and we had a tour coming up. And so I tried to organize my radiation between the two tours that we had. Because canceling a tour is you know,
sure.
complex and
yeah,
all
yeah.
that. But that wasn't probably my best decision. But anyway, you know,
it worked out okay.
It worked
yeah.
out fine.
Yeah.
I had radiation. I went back on the road. And the thing is, you know, I had the therapy of people singing and sending love at me and sending happiness at me. And you know, get on the stage and all this goodness comes at you. I'm sure that was part of the cure for me. I mean, not that I'm cured, but I've been... The third time was in 2005.
When that third time came around, what did you think? Just not again?
Can I jump back to 93 for a second?
Yeah.
So the other thing that happened in 93 when she had her second cancer was she got invited to speak at a breast cancer advance in Montreal, and that...
A national event.
What was, first of all, it was she was probably, I think, the first Canadian public figure to speak about having breast cancer.
Oh, wow.
Homemakers put her on the cover and did an article about her, and then she became involved in founding a breast cancer support and resource organization called Willow.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of this stuff happened as a consequence of her second cancer.
Right.
And, you know, you don't sort of look at these events and say, well, the reason I got cancer was so I could become a cancer advocate.
Right.
I mean, it's not like that. But if you can turn an experience of adversity into something with a purpose and say, look, here I am. I'm an example of coming out the other side of this, and
a
it's okay to
story.
Talk about
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when she first got cancer, it was the C word, and it was something
right.
people didn't talk about. And
so how did you respond to that as her daughter, finding out that your mother had cancer?
Well, it was very, very interesting, actually. When I was first diagnosed, Randy had just moved to California, to San Francisco, and tell her, don't tell her, you know, that all of that dilemma. Of course, that's always a big mistake in my view, that, you know, withholding information from your family is not helpful. So, but my girlfriend, the day I had the surgery, my girlfriend said to me, let your sister tell your parents and let Joe tell Randy so that they don't have to, both my parents and Randy didn't have to hold their own emotions back in order to protect me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very good advice.
Yep.
So
for
Joe
sure.
called you and then we talked.
Yep.
And she, of course, wanted to come home right away. And I said, no, that we don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the second time, after the second diagnosis, when I was invited to speak at this National Forum on Breast Cancer, I felt like I needed to check first. Before I went out there publicly, I needed to check with my husband, my children, and my parents, and my colleagues. Mm-hmm. And once all of them were okay with me doing it, because if I go public, they're public.
Right, sure.
So once they were okay with me doing it, you know, we proceeded, and Randy actually helped me. You know, I kept putting off writing what was I was. I spoke for about an hour at that event, and there had been some debate about who was going to be the keynote speaker. Would it be a scientist or would it be a woman? And ultimately, they decide that they would have both. So Randy finally said, "Just start talking," and she started typing. And from those notes, I was able to put together what I would say at that event, and it was. That was such an important experience for me. I remember a woman who became involved with Willow was the organization, Willow Breast Cancer Support and Research. A woman who was involved on that board eventually, you know, when we created Willow. I met her at the event where I spoke, and she was from Sri Lanka. And she came up to me after I spoke. And she said, she introduced herself, and it took me a while to learn how to say her name, but I did. She was a wonderful person. She died. But she came up to me and she said, "Everything you said today was about me." And that was so significant for me because where she came from, her life experience, her culture, everything was different. And yet when I talked about how it feels, it was right there for her as well. So I learned a lot then.
Yeah. Did you ever have face any pressure in talking about your illness of, you know, people thinking you were an expert or speaking on behalf of other patients? Or did any of these thoughts, because I talk about mental health and suicide a lot. And one of the things that we talk about in this is that, yes, recovery looks different for everybody. That
exactly.
Can't take my story to me.
And I learned that because, just as you obviously did, I believe that talking to other people is a good thing. It's helpful to them and to you. And the person who is the patient talks with, I really feel there's a benefit. But not everybody feels that way.
Right.
Not everybody can do that. And I remember learning that when I was making appointments for the radiation, and the person who was making the appointment said, "Do you want to come before 9 or at lunchtime?" And I said, "Why are you asking me that?" And she said, "Many people choose to make their appointments at those times so that they don't have to tell if they're going to work. They don't have to tell their colleagues." And I was shocked.
Right.
But I came to appreciate, even though I think it's a mistake, but maybe for those people it isn't a mistake. That, you know, some people are apparently not helped by sharing the information. I think maybe if they opened up and did share it, they might be helped. But
it was hard for you the first time, right? You consulted with your entire family, it sounds like.
I consulted with them to make sure that they were okay with me doing
it. You never had any hesitation about opening up about
it. I had friends who'd been down that road. I talked to everybody right away.
Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there's a great benefit in talking about it.
And is that what promoted or what's led to the creation of the support group of Willow?
At the time that it was founded, there was a lot of money being raised for cancer and let's cure cancer.
Right.
And there wasn't a wellspring. There were no support. Systems available, and specifically it was for breast cancer originally. Now it's breast and ovarian and hereditary cancers, and they're part of the Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation and the
Cancer Society.
Yeah. Nice. But at the time, the Canadian Cancer Society raised money to cure cancer.
Right.
And the Canadian Breast Cancer Foundation started as an organization because people wanted to give money for breast cancer research.
Right.
And when Willow started, our goal was for research and support. And we were not competing with the other people out there. And so that was the motivation for starting that organization. And it just kind of...
It evolved over time into... I mean, it was all peer support counseling.
Yeah.
So when you called in, you could you talked to a person someone. Who was a breast cancer survivor.
Yeah. Yeah.
And over time, they developed an extensive library. So if you said, hey, tamoxifen's been recommended for me, they could
send information
to you about it. They wouldn't give you advice about what the right thing is to do, but they could at least help to educate you. And Princess Margaret Hospital, when people would come to them, they would give them a referral to Willow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it was really...
It's a very important organization at the time.
Yeah.
We had wonderful support, yeah.
Yeah. So then the third diagnosis comes along. Obviously, you beat that too. You're still here.
The thing is, you know, first diagnosis, the first thing you think is you're going to die.
Right.
Second diagnosis, why does this have to happen again? Mm. I'm not going to die. And the third diagnosis was, I mean, it's a blow. You don't want to go down that road again. And the thing is, when you're diagnosed, you learn everything you need to know about your diagnosis, about the potential treatments, about all of that. And then when time passes, you can let all of that go. You don't have to hold on to all of that. I could speak intelligently around the time of the diagnosis about the treatments and the options and why and all of that. Not now. Mm. And the last diagnosis in 2005, I had a mastectomy then after that diagnosis.
The good news about the first diagnosis was they caught it very, very early, and then they just started watching her closely forever.
Right. Exactly.
So...
Is there a fear, though, that it'll come back again?
Of course. I have genetic breast cancer, so I have... You know, the chances were that it was going to come back again. Right. Not a complete surprise. But, well, I mean, early days, the first diagnosis, they didn't know.
No. Mm-hmm.
It was after the second diagnosis. And, you know, when I went to the hospital, I had genetic testing. I just thought I was doing it to help with the research. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that I was potentially a candidate. And I was I went by myself, which is kind of stupid. My husband used to go to every appointment with me. Mm. After that, and after he died, Randy comes to all of those appointments with me. But at the time, I went on my own to get the results, and that was probably not very smart. But in the parking lot, I met one of my doctors, and I told her where I was going, and she said, "Remember, knowledge is power." So that was really helpful. The other, she is an interesting woman, because she's not my doctor anymore, but she also said to me on one occasion, when I was debating about treatment, she said to me, "When you make your decision, you make it today based on all the information you have today. Mm. Tomorrow there will be new information.
Right.
You don't have that. You don't beat yourself up for that.
Right.
You take what you have today and you make the best decision you can make based on today."
Yeah.
And so those are two really helpful. I should call her and tell her thank you, because I think about that.
Well, you can send her this episode so that way she can hear you say, yeah.
You know, I don't live in my mother's brain, but I think that it's safe to say that she would in no way say that she spends a lot of time thinking about and worrying about breast cancer.
Right.
I think that it's in the foreground when it needs to be dealt with,
and then it's immediately
in the background.
Yep.
And she's still monitored closely, although it's not statistically necessary anymore.
I mean, the doctor says, you know, you don't have to come back next year. And I said, no, I'd be happy to come back.
We like seeing
to
you once a year.
Yeah.
But it's really not... In any way, she doesn't spend time worrying about it.
No.
And
no, only, you know, the only times that I have a little twinge is if I don't feel well in a particular way that's unfamiliar to me, I think, now, what is that? Mm-hmm. But that's so rare. And, you know, the thing is, you don't know who you're going to be in facing adversity. Until you face it, you don't know who you are going to be. And if someone had said to me, early days, what do you think you'd be like if you had to deal with this kind of challenge? I would have said probably, I'd probably be depressed and anxious. But the fact is, that wasn't who I was in that circumstance. I was positive. I was forward thinking. It was like, let's deal with this and get on with all the other good things that are going on in my life. So you don't know if you're going to be like that.
Sharon Hampson, Randy Hampson, I think we better leave it there.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to mention? Upcoming projects, certainly the book.
Yeah, sure.
And you had mentioned that Skinamarink Day is coming up.
Yes, on the 8th of October.
October 8th, okay.
Yes, we're doing an event in Uxbridge to promote the book for a Blue Heron Bookstore.
Great. Yeah.
And we have new music coming out all the time.
Music.
And,
sure.
And we'll have a new Skinamarink coming out very shortly as well, the revised song.
Well, I want to thank you both, Randy, for continuing your mother's work and for expanding on your mother's work.
Hear, hear.
Sharon, for providing the soundtrack to my childhood, to my kids, and hopefully to their kids someday.
So happy to hear that. When we meet people like you who say that they're exposing their children to the music, that's just the best news that we could get.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
That's it. That's my conversation with Randy Hampson and Sharon Hampson. Sharon is, of course, one third, as you heard, of Sharon, Lois, and Bram, or more recently, over the last few years anyway, from Sharon and Bram since Lois's death. You know, it was to hear her talk about her best friend, Lois, and losing her. You know, it was that was one of those three moments that I said that I almost cried sitting here at the table. But, you know, then to hear about Randy as well and how she's been participating in the activity and the life of the band ever since she was a very young girl. It was such a gift for me to be able to sit here and have that kind of conversation. And I hope you enjoyed it, too. If you want to listen to some of the other conversations that we've had lots of them and we have lots more coming every single Monday. Head over to Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the show, scroll all the way down to the bottom, leave us a nice star rating. A 5-star rating would be good, but if you want to leave less than that, that's cool. Just, you know, explain why in detail in the but no, not really. You can give us a star rating of whatever you feel and leave some comments in the bottom, and that would I would really appreciate that. If you do want to tell me more about how you feel, however, and I read them all, trust me, I have my phone on me all the time checking my Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn and YouTube and everything else. Look me up at Mark Hennick, at MarkHennick. Let me know what you think of the show. Share it, tag me, whatever you want. I'm also at markhennick.com, where you can hear more about some of the episodes and learn more about me and what I do and my speaking and mental health advocacy. That's probably it. If it's not it, I'll remind you the rest of it next time on So-Called Normal.